We're having Jeff Hurton come on, Dr. Jeff Hurton. He's the author of Sobering Truth. And I just want to say that, I mean, I'm very, very pleased that this guy's coming onto the show, because the book medically, academically affected my sort of view on recovery in general, provided me some solid facts, some solid input on what is going on with alcoholism. I wouldn't have read it within my first 90 days of getting sober, for sure. But now that I've gotten more and more sober, this information has become more and more relevant, because it, A, helps me sponsor and help other people with, you know, this sort of information that he's provided. The interesting point is that there has not been one book on the market written like this ever. And I searched. He makes this claim on his website, and I searched for 2.5 weeks. The minute I heard that we got this interview, I was like, okay, well, that's one thing I'm going to be able to knock him on. And there isn't one out there. Dr. Jeff Hurton is a native of California. He resides in San Luis Obispo with his wife, Debbie. His past as a high-functioning alcoholic, his medical expertise, and his life experiences have uniquely equipped him to expose, as they say, the shocking physical, psychological, and social effects of alcohol consumption. It's really a great honor to have him on. Let's go ahead and get him on here. Jeff?
Yes.
How you doing?
Just great.
Good. My name is Josh. I'm with the Addictive Project.
Hi, Josh.
Hi. I'm here with Alexis. She's my partner in crime.
All right.
And so I just wanted to thank you for writing this right off the bat. My sponsor had given this book to me, and I don't know, it's one of those weird things that people in recovery do. They pass books along, right?
Right.
And I actually read it, and I was astounded by what I had actually read, because they don't ever provide you any of this information in the treatment centers.
Right.
And
Josh, they don't know a lot of this stuff.
Right. Right. And so it, one of the talking points that we have here is the sort of like 9 physical effects that is caused by alcohol. Would you mind, you know, running through those for us real quick?
Absolutely. There's quite a few more that have been added since the book was published, but the number one is cancer. There's actually 10 different cancers now that are known to be caused by alcohol, and the two that really stand out is breast cancer in women, and all the GI cancers, mouth, throat, esophagus, stomach, colon, rectum. Of course, liver cancer is very common, especially in people who have advanced liver disease. Prostate cancer has now been associated with drinking hard liquor.
Oh, wow.
And brand new, just this last week, is that association with lung cancer with beer drinking.
Really?
So cancer number one, and we go right down the list. Liver disease, heart disease, osteoporosis, a disease that's epidemic in our middle-aged population, especially women. Number two cause of osteoporosis is alcohol. Very few doctors are even aware of that. Insomnia, number one cause of insomnia in this country is alcohol. Of course, neuropathy, as alcohol wears down the nerves, people start getting these tingling sensations and burning in their feet, so-called peripheral neuropathy from alcohol. Diabetes, recently some studies that showed that stroke is much more common, as is high blood pressure. Of course, fetal alcohol syndrome is a whole other subject, but it's probably the single greatest tragedy of people who drink in child reproductive years.
Okay. Okay. Now, my question to you is, you list these obviously the diseases, osteoporosis being one of them. Now, is it because alcohol somehow destroys the calcium levels in your system?
No. It's real interesting. It does a couple things. First of all, as anybody who's ever drunk beer knows, alcohol is a diuretic.
Right.
It makes you pee. Well, what it does is it increases the urine flow, and you lose calcium in your urine just because of the diuresis that's caused by alcohol, number one. Number two, it decreases parathyroid hormone, a hormone made by these glands right next to your thyroid. And that, by decreasing that, it decreases absorption of calcium from the gut and also increases loss of calcium from the bone. So it's a double whammy. And when you drink, the effect on the parathyroid hormone lasts for 14 to 16 hours. So if you drink every day, you're chronically hypoparathyroid.
Wow. Okay. Now, my other question is sort of like it's twofold. So a lot of people believe that cancer is, some theories out there, it's sort of like immune deficiency. That's essentially what's causing said cancer. And so if a person was to follow that sort of train of thought, would it be safe to say that alcohol reduces or lowers your immune system?
Oh, absolutely. Well, two things, Josh. One is alcohol isn't itself cancer-causing, but its first metabolic breakdown product, acetaldehyde, which is produced throughout the GI tract by bacteria living there and also by your liver, is highly carcinogenic. That's number one. Number two, alcohol suppresses the immune system. And we know that there's this wonderful cell that runs around our body. It's called a natural killer T cell, NKT cells. And these cells identify viruses, bacteria, without any pre-immunity to them. They recognize them as foreign, and they attack them. And that's our number one defense against cancer. Well, alcohol decreases the number of NKT cells in your bloodstream. There's a study where they gave mice, they injected them with melanoma cells, and they put one on an alcohol diet and one on a normal diet. The one on the alcohol diet, every mouse died of melanoma. And on the normal diet, only 25% of them died of melanoma.
That's very interesting stat. So I'm in recovery. I'm a recovering alcoholic myself. And, you know, what they teach you when you go into treatment centers is, you know, obviously alcohol does affect the kidneys and the liver, which can be deadly. Now, but you're talking about cancer, though, which is an entirely different form of what they're telling us. Why do you think that they are not telling us about the cancer aspect of this?
Well, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but this stuff is in the medical literature. It was not hard for me to find this when I started doing research, but it doesn't get to the front page of the newspaper because there's a very powerful and very financially powerful, what we call big alcohol, what they make sure gets on the front pages is the article about how alcohol is good for your heart, so you should have a glass of wine every day for your heart because it's very beneficial. You don't see the other side of that story or the other side of that study that shows that the same people the classic study is that the French people who drink a lot more than we do, especially in wine, live longer, have less heart disease than Americans. Well, the part of the study they didn't tell you was that the French die more frequently of cancer and of suicide than Americans do, but they don't die of heart disease. You didn't see that. You didn't hear that part of the study, and that's because big alcohol never wanted it to get on the front pages.
Right. And well, for obvious reasons. I mean,
obviously.
But, so let's go back in time here. Let's go back to the Prohibition era.
Uh-huh.
And obviously there were some political things that took place to get alcohol legalized again here in this country.
Right.
And we've been walking sort of on stilts, but it's been covered up. When you wrote this book, which is a very powerful tool, was it your purpose to expose the alcohol industry? And if it was, do you know how dangerous that is?
Yeah, I have a full-time bodyguard, and I have a moat around my house. No, I'm just kidding. No, the thing is that I'm this voice crying in the wilderness. I'm like the guy that, you know, first busted tobacco 30 years ago. But what's going to happen, Josh, in the next 10 or 15 years? The truth is just too obvious and too loud not to be heard. And little by little by little, you're going to see alcohol unveiled for what it really is and how harmful it really is. And I look forward to, I just think I'm the vanguard of that. I look forward to 10 years, 15, 20 years from now where everybody recognizes alcohol is dangerous as they do tobacco now.
Okay. Alexis, do you got anything?
No, I'm just fascinated. I guess I just never really kind of thought of it that way. So,
well, let me tell you about a study that was published last October. Lancet, which is the best British medical journal, published a study on all the drugs that are out there, everything from sniffing glue to crack cocaine. They studied all of them, and they ranked them according to the damage that they do to the individual and to the people around the individual. And what do you suppose the number one bad drug was?
Tobacco?
Alcohol.
Alcohol, really?
Alcohol, twice as dangerous to the person and the people around them more dangerous than crack cocaine, more dangerous than heroin, crystal meth, alcohol.
So why would you say that?
And this is a scientific study. This is and the reason is that it affects. It's like a hand grenade. It doesn't, as you know, it doesn't just affect the person that drinks. It affects the whole family circle, the people they abuse, the people they kill on the highway, the people that they beat up, you know, their spouse or their children. This whole circle of people get affected. Plus, it's so much more accessible than a lot of these other drugs.
Right. So as I read through your book, I wouldn't say the word was engaging, because that would mean it was sort of like a fantasy to me. I was more appalled. That's what I should say. And when I look at the some of the points, I was like, what made it so interesting is I was appalled that this hasn't been released out into the atmosphere. You're the first one to actually write about what's going on with this, and that it's always been sort of hush-hushed by AA. Now, it says in your bio that you're a high-functioning alcoholic. What do you mean by that?
Well, I drank.
Do you mind sharing that or no?
I sure. No, by all means. I drank every day.
Okay.
I never drank during the day. As a physician, my level of professionalism and my responsibility to my patients never allowed me to do that. But I would buy a six pack on the way home from work, and I live on a country lane about 2 miles up from a big turnoff. And by the time I got to my mailbox, I had consumed a couple beers. Mm-hmm. Then I'd have a couple more while I fed the horses. And then I'd have a couple more with dinner. And then, depending upon the evening, I might have none after that, or I might have three or four more. I might have, for me, like 2 six-packs would be a lot. Mm-hmm. But if you measured my blood alcohol every night, my blood alcohol was 0.1, I guarantee you. Because I know, I can tell you, with that sweet spot that I enjoy so much, it's right about that 0.8, 0.08, 0.1 percent. I don't want to go over that. That's why I drink beer, because I could always modulate it so well.
Right.
Hard stuff, you get too drunk too fast.
Right.
I would just keep it in that nice little sweet spot. And you know, therein lies, you know, what was I doing? I was using alcohol like a drug, not mm-hmm. like, and of course it is a drug. It took me a long time to realize, you know, I had a problem with amphetamines in college, you know, studying late nights and whatnot. And I was able to quit that, but I never viewed alcohol as the same kind of problem for years and years and years until one day I realized that it had stopped working for me, and I realized I couldn't quit. And then I, as you know from reading the book, I hurt that young boy, you know, totally unintentionally and didn't realize, and I was drunk. And that was my, you know, the guys in my group call me the lowest bottom or the highest bottom they've ever seen. But it was enough of a bottom to me to recognize that I had a serious problem.
So when you were writing this, given your experience that you have, obviously because you are in recovery, you know, there were some views on death, death in general. There were some stories. There was a step-by-step sort of description of a DUI process.
Right.
And was that hard for you to write?
No. I lived in constant fear. I live in a small town, mm-hmm. and if I ever had a DUI, it would be in the paper the next day. And I mean, I could have had 500 DUIs over the years. I was very lucky. I was always drove the back roads. I was really a real stealth driver. But I was terrified when I saw a highway patrol car. My blood pressure just skyrocketed. And thank God, the grace of God, I never had a DUI. Of course, I probably would have quit a lot sooner than I did. But it was such a public humiliation that I'm just very grateful that I never had that.
Yeah, well, and I think in your position, I believe you're a dermatologist, correct?
Right, right.
Yeah, you have a license to practice dermatology, and so anything like that would come up, a DUI, any sort of arrest, would jeopardize your licensure, correct?
Oh, and there's a whole program for physicians, the so-called impaired physician program, and if there's a very strict, recovery issue, and there's all this probation, and your license is suspended, and I mean it's a big deal. And
yeah.
A couple of my friends are recovering physicians as well, but they got busted, and they had to go through this process. And it's a very, very onerous process. I'm really glad I didn't have to go that way.
Yeah, I know a couple of guys that are doctors as well that are, I'm not sure what it's called out here in Colorado, but this is when I was in Orange County, California, and they were going through the same sort of process, and it seemed very, very what they had to actually do.
Right.
So there's only one problem I had with your book, and we're going to go into that, and it's not really
okay.
A problem, but you included a questionnaire.
Right.
That was denial-proof.
Yes.
And given the logic behind alcoholism, and some believe it's a spiritual, and some people believe it's medical, and some people believe it's a combination of, how do you come up with a questionnaire that's denial-proof?
Well, I'm not sure that – I think you busted me because I'm not sure anything is denial-proof. But these are questions that are not the standard questions about alcoholism, that reveal alcoholism. These are really subtle questions. And there's questions that people don't ask very often or at all about drinking. And there are things that, are you afraid to answer the phone after 8 o'clock at night because – someone will might hear that your speech is a little impaired, subtle little things like that. Have not the standard. Have you lost a job? Have you lost your wife? Have you been in jail? Have you had a DUI? Have you had a sexual failure because you were drunk? That's a really common problem with alcoholics. Ask around.
Is it because the blood's too thin at that particular point?
Well, what happens
direction?
Is no, it isn't that so much. It's the suppressing effect. What people don't realize about alcohol is, why do people die of alcohol poisoning? Because alcohol suppresses nerve function. So if you suppress nerve function and you have to have good nerve function to have an erection and to have an orgasm, then it's, very, very often you can't have either when your blood alcohol is like 0.2 or 0.25, especially if you're a middle-aged man where you might be beginning to have a little bit of, erectile dysfunction anyway.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that makes sense, I guess. But with that tool, back to the actual tool, because that's what hung me up. And I'm
right.
Sorry, I'm not trying to bust you. I'm not trying to break your balls here.
Oh, no. It's perfectly okay.
But the problem that I have, okay, so I've been to tons of rehabs. I've been to the good ones. I've been to the low bottom ones. And there's always this questionnaire that they give you, like, when you first go
right,
in.
Right,
it's
the 20 questions.
You fill in
right.
the bubble, and that's great. Could it prove to an individual that he or she may or may not have a drinking problem? I can agree with you. But then when I read the questionnaire, I didn't really have that much of a problem with you because those were the things that I did. And those
right.
were the things that actually happened to me that when I was drinking – and I am an alcoholic, so those all pointed sort of all the same direction. Now, were these questions derived off something you had actually experienced yourself?
Yeah, mostly. The things that I would, when you look back, when you finally get honest and you recover, and then you look back on your life and you say, okay, what were those things? And as well as I do after you've done, your fourth step that, you look back and you look at all the wreckage of the relationships and the way you really abused people and your selfishness and all those sorts of things. And so it isn't just about, whether you ruined a relationship, but did you say a lot of things you didn't mean that hurt people deliberately? Things like that. Those are really alcoholic behaviors that aren't out there on the questionnaire.
Right. So my other issue, I guess I didn't have issue, but my other sort of kind of where I was taken back is, thank God I have a college education, right? And I know how to read, I know how to write, et cetera. But this is very well written,
mm-hmm.
so much to the point where it sounds like you're being snotty.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That makes no. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm saying. Was it hard? Because some of the stories you put out there are very graphic stories.
Right.
And is it your perception, or were you trying to make it universal? I was able to identify with your voice. And trust me, I've read a lot of recovery literature where I was not able to find the voice. And you have a very, very clear, distinct, medical, academic-based voice. And it's very, actually, almost like I was just having a conversation with you. And when I read it, and but was it hard for you not to get the anger in your writing? Was it hard for you not to be upset because of obviously the lack of knowledge of what's going on with alcoholism?
No, I thought that if I just told the story and tried to tell it honestly, that mm-hmm. it would wake people up. And
yeah.
and I, you know, I have to be graphic when I describe somebody dying of, you know, ruptured esophageal varices when they are throwing up literally quarts of blood in my face as I'm trying to lavage their stomach. You know, it's just that's the way it is. And I thought if I really made it real, that people would go, oh my God. You know, so we tell the story of acute alcohol poisoning, the high school kid that, you know, swaps chugs with, you know, of his parents' whiskey with his buddy until he dies. And then we tell the story of the end stage cirrhotic, you know, person with cirrhosis where they have the scarring of the liver and it backs up and makes hypertension in their stomach and then they rupture these varices. Because I want it to be real for people, you know, especially people who drink, who in the back of their mind think they might have a problem but they haven't dealt with it. And all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, this could happen to me. We have a mutual friend of the family who about 4 or 5 months ago woke up and he was yellow.
Oh, wow.
And he's like everybody's friend at the country club, buys everybody a drink after, you know, a round of golf. And he very subtly has developed cirrhosis.
Oh, wow.
And so he's gone to Stanford to see if he can have a transplant, and they won't do it unless he's 6 months recovered. And he's not sure he wants to recover because he'll lose all his friends.
Right.
And
right.
and so it's like, and people say, "My, I didn't know that could happen." Well, that's why I wrote that chapter, was that it can happen. It does
yeah.
happen.
Well, it was very, very detailed, and that's what I enjoyed about it. As maybe that makes me sound a little sick, but the detail that you actually applied to the stories, you didn't brush over anything, and reading it gave me a good feeling of what was going on, and that's very, very hard to do as a writer in general, because it's hard to describe addiction to the masses, if that makes sense. It's hard to describe
exactly.
the shock of waking up yellow, or, you know, like the situation you were discussing about with the esophagus. And so, you know, I applaud you. I mean, again, I love the book. I didn't mean to say that it sounded snotty. I just wanted to say
it came
around very medically sound. Yeah, I mean, just it came across very, very medically sound. That was all. Alexis?
Yeah.
The one thing that I really enjoyed about this book is that it covers the spectrum of kind of all the walks of life of alcoholism. And so it's, you know, it's not just for like a man to read or a woman to read or a teenager to read or a college student to read. It really covers and goes in depth of the consequences of, you know, alcoholic behavior.
Right.
And
well,
in a very detailed manner. And I think I know that hasn't been done. And I think that it really needs to be read by a lot of people. I don't, you know, it covers the gambit. And I think that that's a very important tool, a very useful tool, and a very needed tool.
Well, thank you. That's a very nice compliment.
Let's talk about the chapter of informed consent on informed
yes.
consent. You know, let's get back to the book a little bit and its nitty gritty details. I always get caught up in the art of it, so just and me. I'm sorry.
It's perfectly,
you know,
okay.
But so tell us about the chapter on informed consent.
Well, I've actually been giving that in the form of lectures to high school kids. I talked to a middle school last week, kids in a program called AVID that are kind of at-risk kids that if they got the right encouragement could go on to college, but they're kind of in limbo right now. And basically, the informed consent is as if you go to a physician to have a procedure. Let's say you're going to have a colonoscopy or something like that, and it is a responsibility of the physician to tell you all the possible things that could go wrong during that procedure, the possible allergic reactions, the this, the that, everything. And so to inform you of that so that you can make a decision whether or not you want to have that procedure. And that process is called the informed consent. So I decided to do an informed consent for alcohol. And based on all of these things that we've talked about, all the medical problems, and there's actually, as you know, there's a little checklist, not a checklist, but there's actually a form you know, in the book where you initial each one of the things like you do when you rent a car that you don't want the insurance and that kind of thing. I understand that, you know, if I get pregnant and I'm drinking, that I can have a child who's just severely neurologically impaired. And then all these things, all right down the list. And at the end it says, being of sound mind and body and having been informed of all these things, I still choose to drink. And then you sign it. And that's the informed consent. And we actually pass these little questionnaires out to the kids before I give the lecture, and then we ask to collect them at the end of the lecture.
Yeah, that's a very useful tool for sure. I never had anybody at my school ever do anything like that, so that would be interesting to check out. Do you ever do anything in the Colorado area, or is it just all Northern California?
I haven't yet, but I'll go anywhere, anytime.
Okay. Cool.
I've talked to the Bar Association, the Women's Bar here in the county, and I've been asked to talk down in Santa Barbara to the Bar Association at their annual. They have requirements for their continuing education for drug and alcohol, and so that I'm going to be the speaker for that in January down in Santa Barbara. And so little by little, I did a video of this talk that I gave at the middle school last week, and we're going to have that available on the website. And that's something that would be such a great tool for parents, because mm-hmm. if they want to show that, they want to sit down and watch that with their kids. You know, kids today are much more interested in media and video than they are in reading a book.
Right.
So sit down and watch that with the kids, because we go through, I start by telling a story of a girl who drowned in a hot tub 2 weeks ago at one of our fancy Shell Beach hotels here. She was 19 and she was drinking after the rehearsal dinner, and her boyfriend went to bed, and he woke up 2-3 in the morning and she wasn't there, and he went back to the spa and she was drowned in the hot tub, still clutching a bottle of Jack Daniels.
Wow.
And
wow.
I started my talk with that, with these 12, 13, 14-year-old kids, and I immediately had their attention.
Wow. Wow, that's, you'd have my attention, that's for sure.
And then I follow that up with a good friend of mine who's a high school counselor, and the first two kids she saw this year at the beginning of the school year were two girls who were raped at a party at parties because they passed out.
And that's actually very, very common, unfortunately.
Yes.
It's too common. The stats are huge on that.
Exactly.
So my question to you is, so let's get back to talking about you then. So you're an alcoholic.
Right.
If you would have been informed of all the nasty crap that this stuff can do to your body, would that have prevented you from ever drinking or taking that first drink?
I don't think so. And I tell the kids I talked to last week, I said, I'm not trying to get you not to drink. I don't think that getting people to abstain is a realistic mm-hmm. option for most people. It just, you know, if you say you don't drink at all, you just turn off 90% of your audience immediately. They've just stopped listening to you. So I say, I want you to think about drinking in moderation, and I want you to watch to see if you develop any of these problems. Lady called me and told me that she read the book, and she said, you know, I haven't stopped drinking, but I'm looking in the rearview mirror a lot more, and I see, you know, when I'm drinking, when I have a glass of wine every day, you know, I notice it, and I notice that I'm heading toward having a problem. And that's what, you know, I mean, I don't think, you know, prohibition didn't work.
Right.
And you know, those of us who are alcoholics, we're the unfortunate 10% of men and 5% of women. But there's another 90% out there that drink, and I don't know how they do it, Josh.
Yeah.
You know, they're normies. They're earth people. You know, you and I have spent a lot of years trying to get along with them because we don't understand them.
We don't.
How can they do that? How can they just have a glass of wine?
I don't know. My father has a quart of beer that sits in his refrigerator.
I know. Isn't that amazing?
Half-open
bottle of wine.
Yeah.
How do you do
drink
that?
It.
Yeah.
It's 3-2 beer, which is even worse. So,
oh, yeah. That's right. You have 3-2 beer in Colorado, don't you?
Yeah, we have three. Well, back in the day before they, you know, legalized it where it could be sold on Sundays, on Sunday all you could, you know, buy here in Colorado was 3-2 beer. But now they've made it 6-0 and above, so all the liquor stores are opening. So they must be going broke or need more money. So with that knowledge that you have, with you know, that it's not going to prevent anybody from drinking in the long run. It's not. I mean, it might pause, it might stop, and heck knows, there's probably a percentage out there that your book would actually prevent somebody that's as health conscious as maybe some of your students are that you discuss this with. Does it make you, does it feel like you're being hypocritical? Because you kind of know what's down the road.
No. I'm just being realistic.
Okay.
Like, you know, it's just not realistic to say, you know, like MAD, the Mothers Against Drunk Driving, I've tried to partner with them, but their attitude is complete abstention. Well, it's just not going to work. It's just not going to happen. And so my tack is this. I mean, I've been working on this for a couple of years now. I really think I understand the problem. The problem is reaching kids before they are an established drinkers. Kids start as early as 9. Mm-hmm. By 13, 50% of kids have tried it. By 15, 50% of kids are drinking regularly. So we need to reach them at 12, 13, 14, when they're still receptive, when they're not skeptical, and when they're not so tight with their peer group that they'll actually listen. So my thrust is this middle school. I want to talk to every, I want this video seen by every middle school kid in the country. So that's the group that we can educate. By the time they get to college, it's been shown that Alcohol Justice, the big website here that used to be the Marin Institute, very alcohol watchdog website, they just say education doesn't work, period. Well, I don't think they're right. I think education works if you do it at the right time. That's the first thing. The second thing is we need to tax alcohol more.
Okay.
Studies have shown that if you tax it more, there's less consumption.
And what would you suggest that tax rate be, just out of curiosity, off the top of your head?
What, you mean tax?
Yeah. Well, how much should they
tax?
Well,
it's interesting. In California, this is how strong the alcohol lobby is. There has not been a tax increase on alcohol in California since 1991. That's 20 years.
Wow.
And if you look at the harm that alcohol causes, we're talking in the billions of dollars.
Right.
So, and it's a very difficult, it's not something that, you know, the last time they had a tax increase, if you looked at the campaign that Big Alcohol put up against it, it was in the, you know, in the millions and millions of dollars. So it's not an easy process. But there's this thing where they tax for the, actually you can figure out cost-wise what the harm is that alcohol costs in drunk driving, in homicide, in spousal abuse, and you can put a number on that. And you can figure out from that what kind of, and I'm not an economist, so I'm not going to throw a number at you, but you can actually figure out what percentage of the cost of that alcohol reflects all the damage that it is doing to society. I gave a talk a few months ago, and in California, alcohol cost the taxpayers $11 billion last year. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean buying the booze. I'm talking about, you know, lost job, you know, lost time of work. I'm talking about death. I'm talking about people disabled in vehicular accidents. There's a number out there that they figured. It's $11
billion. $11 billion. But that's
a lot
large
of money. You know, that's the gross national product of a lot of countries.
Exactly. That's the GMP for sure. I am, however, an economist. That's sort of what I do as a job. Sort of what I do is what I study anyways and gone to school for. And I came up with a number that was 31%. 31%.
I think that sounds great.
Would be the appropriate, because that would cover any damage and any future damage caused by this.
And I think that's great. And the only thing is I can already hear the howl.
Oh, yeah.
Coming from, and you know, the last argument was last year there was an initiative here to increase tax on alcohol, and the alcohol lobby came out with huge amounts of money against it, and their thing was that in a down economy that it would hurt the economy even more.
Oh, I'm sure.
Isn't that
impossible.
Great?
Yeah, it's impossible. It's the people don't understand the inputs and outputs, and it's kind of disgusting when you read that and then they print it nationally, because it's a very blanketed sort of statement, and it drives me crazy when I open up the New York Times and you read something like that, Harvard Business Journal just did an article, I think it was like two issues ago, and it was saying that if we were to legalize, it was about legalization of marijuana and how it would do X, X, and Y, but what they forgot is the crime that goes along with that and how that, you know, that basically just stops everything.
Well, and it's a gateway drug. I'm sorry. It is.
Yeah.
You know, I worked in that tattoo clinic that, you know, for 5 years, and I took care of all those parolees and all those gang members, and every single one of them had two common threads, and one was drugs and the other was marijuana. I mean, one was alcohol and the other was marijuana.
Right.
And when they couldn't score their heroin, you know, they could always fall back on weed and on, you know, cheap wine.
Right, exactly. Moonshine. We have a lot of people in recovery listening tonight, because that's the majority of our fan base, and I would probably venture to say 75-80% of them are alcoholics. And, you know, and so back to the medical part of this, though. Okay, so you're saying that we have to grab the kid, the child, the 12, 13-year-old range. But according to what was recently released by the AMA, that it's actual a disease, and it's a genetic disease. Did I read that incorrectly?
It's fascinating. I'll tell you. I don't know if have you heard of a book called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts?
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Gabor Mate.
Yeah,
unbelievable book. But he goes through the neurophysiology of addiction, especially both alcohol and drugs. But his take on it is that there is a genetic component, but there is also an acquired component.
Okay.
And, you know, the mechanism is that you decrease your dopamine receptors on the neurons in the pleasure center in the midbrain and the limbic system. Okay, so dopamine makes us feel really, you know, when you do a bungee jump, you have a high dopamine level for like a half an hour afterwards. That's the elation drug that we produce. And when you drink, when you have that first drink, you increase dopamine. But as you continue to drink, you decrease the receptors for it so that your neurons can't get as much. And it's a physiologic thing, and that's the physiologic basis for addiction. Now, there are people who are born with not enough dopamine receptors, not the normal amount. And those people are kids with fetal alcohol, and they are kids who are they're born with a normal number, but after the first year of life, they have a decreased number, and it's because they were not nurtured in their first year of life. And there's science behind all this. There's references for all this in Gabor Mate's book. So, and then it's been shown that teenage alcoholics, when they drink, they get a proportionately higher decrease. That's a double positive, but what I mean is their decrease in dopamine receptors is even more severe than, say, an adult would be. So that makes them more prone. The younger a person starts drinking, the more likely he is to be alcoholic.
Hmm.
And the fact of the matter is 25% of all alcoholics are teens.
Okay. But I understand the word alcoholic completely different than maybe the medical association, because I understand alcoholism as a spiritual malfunction, although there is the medical side.
Absolutely.
With
absolutely.
That. But, and I always go head to head with that, and I don't really do it on purpose, but for me, when I hear medicine and there's a medical issue, that means that there's a pill's right around the corner.
Oh, I know, and now, I hate that. Here's the pill that's going to solve the problem for you.
Right. So you're a doctor, and yet you're in recovery.
Right.
There has to be some sort of battle for you. Is there not a battle?
No, there isn't.
Okay.
If you know the saying, we all talk about how we're not comfortable in our own skin.
Right.
And a drink fixes that.
Right.
That feeling of not enough or discomfort in your own skin, that is not enough dopamine. That's where
okay.
it comes from. And so all the feelings of self-hatred and the poor image and all that stuff has a biochemical basis. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't do the spiritual work and increase that dopamine. We can.
Okay.
But there, you know, I'm a scientist, but I'm also have an enormous spiritual side to me, and I could not have gotten sober without my higher power.
Right.
There's just no way.
Okay.
So, but the thing is, I see it. I see both. I see it as, okay, this is the problem spiritually, and I, you know, I think the 12 steps is it's an absolute miracle. It's just, I mean, it's just a miracle. And how many non-alcoholics could benefit from it,
right,
by living their lives? I mean, you know, promptly admitting it when you're wrong. I mean, how many people could benefit from the 12 steps?
Right. I agree. So back to what your original statement was, or statement was a few minutes ago, was so the dopamine's dropped. So if
right.
the dopamine's dropped, it makes you uncomfortable in your own skin.
Right.
Then us drinking increases our dopamine. So
right.
school of thought or rationale would be give somebody something that would increase their dopamine and that would take away the alcoholism. But would that be an incorrect statement or sequence
there,
of logic?
You know that there's somebody out there that wants to do that, that wants to just look at this as a clinical problem and not as a spiritual problem and say, here's the pill that, you know, will increase your dopamine and it won't drop your receptors and you'll be a happy camper and you'll be fine and you won't need to drink.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and you know that's going to happen. It's just out there. But the thing is, I don't think that doesn't make for contentment and serenity.
Right.
That just makes people not drink.
Right. So, interesting fact, you brought it up, and 25% of all teenagers are alcoholics.
Right.
Where'd you get that number?
Oh, shoot. You know, I've done so much research.
Fact.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I could go back. It's actually in one of my blogs, and I quote some article from somewhere.
Yeah, I'd actually read that in part
yeah.
of your blog. And
here's some numbers I'll tell you that will blow your mind.
Okay.
WHO, World Health Organization, did a paper on alcohol last fall, a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
The number one cause of death in men between 15 and 54 years of age worldwide is alcohol. Number one cause. More than
wow.
TB, more than HIV, more than war. You know, we send billions of dollars to Africa to fight HIV,
mm-hmm.
and less people die of it than die of alcohol worldwide.
Wow.
Isn't that a mind-boggling terrible. Number?
Yeah.
There are whole generations, like in Russia, there's a whole generation of men that are dying because they're binge drinking. They're just killing themselves off. A third of all alcoholics, well, you probably know that, or a third of all alcoholics die of suicide.
Yeah.
And it's because alcohol is a depressant.
Right. So since we have you on here, I want to sort of walk through this. When a person dies of alcohol poisoning, it's easy to call it alcohol poisoning and just label it that. But what is actually physiologically going on with the body when that happens?
Oh, it's remarkable. Okay, well, let me just take you through the basically the four stages. Okay, so you and I are swapping shots of whiskey. So we have a couple shots, and our blood alcohol goes to 0.1.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel really good. That's the place I've always wanted to be when I was drinking, is that 0.1. You just, no cares, no worries. The mortgage payment was made and the kids, you know, did okay in school. And, you know, that's just the great spot. But we're drinking hard tonight, so we go on. And the reason that 0.1 makes you feel so good is that it's working on the cerebral cortex. It's working on the inhibition impulse control part of the brain, and it's removing those inhibitions and those impulse controls. And that's, you know, that feeling. That's the great feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But we keep drinking, and after another couple shots, we get to 0.2, and now the alcohol is affecting deeper in the brain to the cerebellum, which is the balance control. That's where you can't pass a sobriety test because you can't put your one foot right in front of the other and you can't put your feet together and lean back and close your eyes with your arms out without falling over because your cerebellum, base of the brain, is being affected by the alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
So then we continue to drink. We get to 0.3, and at 0.3 is when we are falling down drunk. This is where people are passing out. And if they're lucky at that point, they also get really dizzy and they'll throw up. Because if they throw up, they can get rid of some of the alcohol and it doesn't keep going up and they don't die from it. I drank in college. I mean, I was an unbelievable drunk in college. And, I mean, it just amazes me that I didn't kill myself. But the reason I never did is because I always got sick before I passed out. And I threw up whatever was in my stomach, so my blood alcohol didn't keep going up after I passed out.
Mm-hmm.
So that point three is getting to the brain stem where all the really primal functions occur, and it's just getting there and it's affecting consciousness. But then as we drink some more, we get to point four, it gets to the vital structures that are in the brainstem, and that is blood pressure, respiration, temperature. You know, that's why that girl died in the hot tub, because you lose temperature control, and you vasodilate all your blood vessels, which drops your blood pressure, and your unconsciousness is more profound, and you basically drown because her blood pressure, she basically passed out, but in a state that, you know, if you just pass out and throw somebody cold water on somebody, you know, and they're not that deep, they'll come around. Well, she didn't. So then you keep drinking, and you get to those lower functions, and the lower function that really finishes you is respiration. People stop breathing, and it's because the brainstem is being poisoned by the alcohol. Now, if you happen to have some OxyContin on board, you're even more unlucky, because you can stop breathing with OxyContin with a blood alcohol of like 0.25. There was a kid from our town who finished his finals his senior year, went out drinking. His parents were going up to his graduation that weekend in Chico, and he died. And he died with a blood alcohol of 0.29, should not have died with 0.29, but he had OxyContin on board. And they are synergistic in causing respiratory arrest.
Mm-hmm.
Once you stop breathing, the heart can only last for maybe a minute or two without oxygen, because the acidosis that is produced causes basically a ventricular tachycardia, fibrillation, and death.
So my question to you, and this is more of a personal question. When I entered into treatment, I had always carried a breathalyzer with me, and when I entered into treatment, I blew a 5.12 at, like, I think it was like,
holy moly,
12 in the morning. But I'd worked my way up to that, and that was on Anabuse.
Yeah.
How is that physiologically possible?
I don't know. The highest that I've ever seen is 4.5, and that was a person who was conscious.
Right.
You know, I worked at L.A. County Hospital, and we saw a lot of really heavy-duty drunks. And I saw a guy with 0.45, and I was busy with another patient. I turned around, and he'd actually left. He got up and left the hospital with a 4.5.
Yes.
But I've never seen over 0.5. I've never seen a 0.5. And, you know, I don't know, maybe the breathalyzer, you'd say, well, maybe it wasn't totally accurate. I don't know. But you're lucky to be here, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, that was actually when I got there, I blew higher than the 5.12, and they actually took me to the hospital and withdrew the blood from my arm.
Yeah.
And so
it was a 0.5.
It was a 0.512.
Oh, God.
But I always just wondered that, and that's in my mind where a higher power, in my opinion, beat out anything medical.
Right.
You know, where something greater than myself, obviously, you know, took care of me, because God knows, you know, I wasn't going to be able to do it.
And that just astounds me. I mean, that's one for the record books.
Yeah, that's what everybody keeps on telling me.
It's sort of a dubious record, though, Josh.
Yeah. A lot of the kids called me an AP honor student while I was there, so that was funny.
You always wanted to excel, right?
I always wanted to excel. You know, why not at this? And the weird thing was, I was completely conscious. I felt kind of low that day. You know,
God.
So your website claims, some of the notes we got claims that everybody should read this book. I agree with that. And I think it's good for a non-alcoholic and an alcoholic, somebody that's dabbling in drinking, to read this. But did you write this to make amends to society? I just wanted to ask.
No.
You didn't?
No. I wrote this book out of gratitude.
Okay.
I am so grateful. I mean, you know the kind of gratitude. Josh, I could still be drinking.
Right.
And I don't know where I would be if I were still drinking, because if you look at the last couple of years of my drinking, mm-hmm. I was on a really steep downward path. And I just don't know, I just can't imagine. So when I got sober and then I had this crisis where I was in Wyoming. My wife and I ride horseback, and I was riding a horse across on the Pony Express Trail across country. And my horse colicked in northern Wyoming. and colic, horses, if they colic and you can't get them out of colic, they're going to die in 24 hours because they get all these toxins in the stomach because the stomach is paralyzed. So the vets at the ride said to me, you got to get this horse out of here. You're going to lose him. This is a horse that I was dearly, dearly in love with. And so I drove that horse from Stinking Creek, Wyoming, to Fort Collins, Colorado, to Colorado State, to the vet school. I drove him all night there. Now, 6 months before, when I was drinking, I couldn't have done that. And I couldn't because I would have had four or five beers by then. I would have, you know, I would have been not, I would have fallen asleep. I could never have gotten there. I got him there. They saved him. I brought him home from the ride. He's out in my pasture right now. I see him every day. And as I was driving back from the ride, you know, from Fort Collins, you know, and just so incredibly grateful, number one, to be sober. Number two, to have done something I could not have done 6 months before because I was sober, save a horse that I just dearly loved. And I was just this incredible gratitude. And this little voice said, do something about it. You know, you really like to write. You're a good writer. I teach dermatology at University of California, Irvine, and I'm really kind of a, not a frustrated teacher, but I'm really a teacher by nature. So this little voice said, you know, you like to teach and you're a good writer, so write about alcohol. And teach people what it's really all about. I had no idea what I was going to find when I made that. And so I committed myself to do that right there in the car driving back from Fort Collins. And I had no idea what I was going to find, and I had no idea what I was getting into. You know, this is quite a journey.
Right. And but, it's very taxing.
But the thing is, it's, you know, I'm committed. I'm committed like I think you're committed, or you wouldn't be doing what you're doing.
Interesting. I did two semesters at UCI when I was out in Orange County, and I love that school. It's a fantastic school.
Oh yeah.
My undergrad, and I love that area. I love Orange County in general. I lived in Costa Mesa though, so but it's on the side of Jamboree. So we want to support you. People listening probably want to get your book. Tell us how we get your book. Where do we need to go?
Okay.
And I know it's on Amazon. I know you have a website.
You can get it at. A lot of the bookstores have it. If they don't have it, they get it. Matt, you know, Amazon, all the big names have it. Ebooks, really popular. You can get it on ebooks at any of the ebook sites. All of them it's available. You can get it from our website, and the shipping is free. And the other thing you can get at the website is there is a blog. There's all kinds of excerpts from the book, but there's also some video. Some lectures I gave to some fraternity kids from Cal Poly that were on the informed consent. And there's also a video from Australia that was a public service campaign that they did for the holidays, drunk driving. And it is the single most powerful video I have ever seen about drunk driving. And just going on the website, just to see that alone would be worth it. Just go on and it'll say videos and click on successful campaign, Australian campaign. And you'll see this, it's like a 2-minute video, and it's just incredibly powerful. I mean, if it just doesn't, you know, give you the shivers, you don't have a nervous system.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the truth. Alexis, do you got anything for Dr. Jeff?
Really, I just wanted to say thank you for the fetal alcohol syndrome chapter, chapter 25.
You know, we didn't even talk about that, Alexis, and that is such an incredible... and that's something I talk about when I do the informed consent talk. It's amazing. As little as a single ounce of alcohol a day can affect the IQ of a child.
I think it's just phenomenal because it's just considered socially acceptable. Like, oh, I just had a glass of wine. I'm not drinking real alcohol. It's not harmful. My doctor encourages it. And I think that those facts just really make it crystal clear of how dangerous that is.
Absolutely. And we have a real battle going on here because some of the OBGYNs aren't on board with us. We have a really strong advocacy group here for, you know, against fetal alcohol. And some of the OBGYNs said, just like what you said, it's okay to have a glass of wine now and then. And our position is... there's absolutely zero tolerance for alcohol during pregnancy, zero. And we did a study of women at Cal Poly, and 56% of them were drinking during pregnancy.
What do you think? what do you think of the proponents that say that it's in fact healthy for the mother and therefore healthy for the unborn child because of depression or anxiety or if they go into labor too soon?
It's just insane. Well, now that's different. You can stop labor with alcohol, IV alcohol, but that's at a late stage. That's, the brain is already formed. You know, when alcohol is really so harmful is the first and second trimester. After the second trimester, you know, the brain is pretty well formed, and you're not going to hurt that mother by giving her IV alcohol to, but that's a rare circumstance to stop a premature labor. But it's not that. It's the first trimester when the brain is getting organized. There's a little center in the brain of the fetus called the organizer, and it tells what neurons where to go. You know, you're going to be a cerebellar one, and you're going to be memory, and you're going to be a math neuron and that sort of stuff. And the organizer depends on a chemical called retinoic acid, which is the acid form of vitamin A. Well, retinoic acid is inhibited by alcohol. So people who drink in that first trimester, the brain is totally disorganized, and it's structurally grossly malformed. I showed those kids at Mesa Middle School last week a picture of a fetal alcohol brain next to a brain of a healthy 6-week-old child. And the fetal alcohol brain is about half the size. And it's all misshapen. It doesn't even look like a brain. It's a huge, and the other thing is, so the kids that don't have gross fetal alcohol syndrome, sometimes they just have learning disabilities. We don't know how many of our ADD kids are really subclinical fetal alcohol.
Right. I was just going to ask, you know, if there have been studies on just down the line, when a kid's 12, 13, 14, are they going to have developmental issues that...
They absolutely are. They absolutely are. We had a seminar out here. It's called Rethinking Drinking, a day-long seminar, and we had a nurse who is an expert on fetal alcohol. And the interesting thing is she has a child. She adopted a child with fetal alcohol. And so she's had all the experiences of, you know, dealing with these learning disabilities. These kids cannot be mainstreamed. They can't. They have to have special schools. They can't work. They'll never hold a job. They have floppy muscles, so they have very poor coordination. They can't do any kind of athletics. It's an absolute tragedy because it's one of those things like the hand grenade we talked about, because it's not their fault. It was done to them by a totally unthinking person who drank during the pregnancy.
I think that's the part that always got me, and the argument that the mothers had and that the doctors that supported it had, were that it was, you know, well, it's the benefit of the mother. And I'm like, well, the unborn child isn't getting a voice.
You know,
it's like...
Exactly.
You know, when does it become the health of the child is predominant over the comfort level of the mother?
Right. I totally agree with you.
Well, Jeff, our hour is done. We want to thank you again for coming on here with us and chatting with us for the last hour. It was good to put a voice to the reading, that's for sure. And do you have a follow-up on what you're going to write? Are you going to do another book, or is there
no? Not right now. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give a lot of talks, and I'm going to ask people to get that video for their kids. You know, I'm really talking to young parents with kids in middle school. I want them to sit down with their kids. I want to have, and so I'm going to, the next year or two, it's going to be my push is going to be to talk to as many groups as I can, to get as many people as I can to see that video for the middle school kids. And we have a program for the middle school kids where we talked about with them, what about, you know, why did that girl get raped, you know, when she passed out? And it was because nobody was watching out for her. She didn't have a friend at that party that would watch out for her, and that's a darn shame. So we have a program where we have bracelets that the kids wear that says, "I've got your back."
Cool.
And it means that if they go to a party where alcohol is present, they're going to wear that bracelet, and they're going to have a friend that they're going to watch out for to make sure that something terrible, like an unwanted pregnancy or a STD or, you know, a date rape, doesn't happen.
That's an amazing concept. That's an awesome idea. I hope it works out for you guys. That's really, really cool. Do you have anything for us? Are we good to go?
No, listen, I just really appreciate the opportunity. You know, I've got a message, and any ears that will listen, I'm willing to give it.
Definitely. Well, we're going to see. We'll get with some of the county officials out here, and I didn't know that you were open for talks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
anytime. I'll send you that video should be ready next week, Josh, and I'll send it to you.
Cool. We'll get it on our website.
And even take it and have the superintendent of schools watch it and see if they'd like to have me come out and do an assembly or something like that.
Will do. We can definitely do that. Thank you very much for coming on.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
All right, thank you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's Dr. Jeff Herden, the author of The Sobering Truth. And you can purchase any of his material, or actually the book, at www.thesoberingtruth.com. Well, Alexis, what did you think?
You know, I find the medical aspect profound. And what I like and what I'm about bringing on a doctor that can discuss it is it breaks it down into layman's terms that can be understood.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's what I like. I mean, I like to have that clinical knowledge besides, you know, philosophical theory. You know, it just, it all builds on, you know, educating.
Well, if you don't know, now you know, nigga. What? Seriously? Well, I enjoyed talking to him. I enjoyed the book, you know. I mean, I don't really, you know me, I don't really, you know.
You don't enjoy it much.
A lot of writers. I don't enjoy much. Let alone
well, no, and the thing is, it was funny, as I was going through the book, and I don't know all the medical lingo, and I was like, shit, I got to Google this, or I got to email Josh and say, what the hell does this mean? Like, you know, like, I don't know. I know he does.
I'm a secret
But I just think,
work.
I mean, there were parts in it that were just, you know, I mean, it's just heart-wrenching. You read those stories, and if anybody has been touched by addiction, and I doubt anybody hasn't been, you're going to have a memory triggered because either you've seen it, you've heard it, it's been you, it's been a loved one, it's, you know, we've all been there.
Right.
It's just harsh.
I think it goes along with this, with saying if anybody's been touched by Santa Claus, they should probably call the cops.
Oh, my. Santa better be good. No, Santa came to me today in the form of UPS with a new iMac. That's my Santa.
Dude, I got sent me a text and a picture. I was like, what the fuck is she sending me a picture of her computer for? I forgot that she had to pack it up and mail it. All right, then. Well, do you have anything else you want to holler at these people, or are you good to go?
No, I think we're good to go.
All right. Again, we want to thank Dr. Jeff Herden, the author of The Sobering Truth, and his book can be purchased at thesoberingtruth.com. Of course, per the usual, we're going to end with a little Bill Hicks tonight. Talk to you guys later.